Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hi everyone, Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. My guest today is the entrepreneur's entrepreneur. He started life learning how to code and started building websites at a young age, which turned into a digital marketing agency, which he then sold to a publicly listed company. Using that skill set, he created another website, which many of you will be familiar with, Finder.com, which is a comparison website that is hugely popular and that business does over $100 million a year in revenue. As part of that journey, he's been featured in the AFR Young Rich List. And now he's involved in the world of open banking, democratizing banking, changing the way that we do things, a true disruptor, a true innovator. And I'm talking about Fred Shibesta. Fred is an amazingly talented businessman, but above all else is an incredibly thoughtful and philosophical human being. What I really appreciated about my conversation with Fred today was his thoughtfulness and his consideration. And it's clear to me that Fred is on a journey. He's got a purpose and a mission that goes beyond just, you know, creating a business. He's looking to enrich the lives of the world of which he is part. I found this conversation incredibly stimulating, incredibly interesting, and of course, really applicable to understanding the process of creativity in business and understanding that business is as much art as it is science. I really hope you enjoy this conversation with Fred. I did, and I really hope you do too. So here's Fred Shibesta. Fred Shibesta, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Thank you so much for hanging out with us this afternoon. How are you, mate?
Very good. Very good. And thank you. And for whatever time anyone's listening, I appreciate you tuning in. You found the best podcast right now.
Oh, mate, you are very kind. You are really kind. Hey, Fred, your background is a really interesting, rich and diverse background. We were just talking off air a moment ago. You know, you've got some connections to Canberra, where I am at the moment, but your business is based in Sydney. And, you know, the business that you're mostly known for is Finder.com, as the founder of Finder, which is an amazing business, which we'll come to in a minute. But you had an internet marketing agency, a digital marketing agency, which you sold at a young age. I'm curious to understand where your entrepreneurial journey began. What sparked that flame for you?
Well, As a kid, I used to ride bikes and climb trees and buy milk bottles and Redskins from the corner shop and get up to no good on my skateboard. So I don't know if that's that was not the time of enterprising and entrepreneurialism, but I definitely, you know, I used to sell a few weird and wacky things at school when I got my hands on them. But, you know, I don't think I really began then. I think I started building websites just for the interest's sake and taught myself to code HTML. And my next door neighbor actually invited me over one day and said, "Can you build my website for me? And how much will you charge me?" I said, "You want me to charge you money to do something I love?" I'm like, "Sure, let's do that. That's an incredible idea." And I think I've always been one to sort of pick up very quickly on where potentially a dollar could be made in some way, but more importantly, how a dollar can be made scalably and, you know, repeatedly over time. That's more what I'm interested in, and have refined that process. You know, in the beginning, building websites was a brutal business. That was probably 7 years of brutality. And I don't think that was probably, probably should have gotten out a little earlier than I did, but, you know, went through the whole cycle and sold that business. But that's sort of where I began. And, you know, I think always been kicking around ideas.
I like the idea of scalability, Fred. That's one of the things that, you know, fascinates me as well. And I'm curious to ask, you know, with your marketing agency, did you manage to actually scale that in the end? Did you manage to do that before you exited, or not so much?
You know, I think we had sort of 20 people and we billed, I don't know, $2 million in a year. And that was hard work. That was a lot of work. And we were proud of that back then, you know, and we thought that was a lot of money. And you know, now not we don't really think, see it like that in the same way. But I think, yes, we did scale it a little bit, but just in the most, like just the worst ways you could possibly do that, and made every mistake, you know, not proceduralizing, you know, organizing roles, defining responsibilities, and, you know, setting, you know, key performance, and just, yeah, everything was just very, very broken. And that was just because I didn't know what I was doing. I was a very young kid. You know, I was 22 years old. So,
yeah,
you know, trying to manage a whole group of people and figure out how to run a business at the same time. You know, I remember we, at one point, we were $250,000 in debt. So we owed 150 grand to the tax man. We owed a law firm 70 grand and we had payroll coming up.
Oh, wow.
And we didn't have the money. So that was probably the bottom. And I mortgaged my shares. I got a margin loan for, I think it was 14, 15%. And I paid the payroll. And then we cut costs and we slowly dug our way out of that and, yeah, got up and out of that.
Yeah, that's really interesting because there'll be a lot of people listening to this podcast that might have experienced something similar to that. And you mentioned, you know, you scaled in the worst possible way by not proceduralizing, not having, you know, clear parameters around responsibility or KPIs or anything of that nature. I want to talk about that kind of business versus Finder. And Finder is obviously a business that easily scales because it's a digital platform and it's a great site, of course, comparison site. And I'll ask you about the history of that in a minute. But with a personal services business or a business such as the agency, do you think they are truly scalable in any way, or is it just you're going to be able to, you know, leverage more than scale?
It's a man hours business.
Yeah.
The part I'm challenged by, unfortunately, with an agency or any, you know, consultancy in and of itself, is that you're slightly adversarial in that you want to basically contribute the least amount of work you possibly can and get, you know, the most amount of money from it in that time, and do that by spending the least amount of costs, right? So, and the third outcome of that is that the client gets a good outcome.
Yep.
Which, at the end of the day, it's their responsibility. And so, yeah, it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Right? I think that trilemma, unfortunately, in an agency is kind of broken, and that's why the agency model is kind of, you know, slowly over time dissipated. I think there are parts of it where it does work, you know, in terms of creativity, in terms of, you know, getting access to people that you wouldn't normally hire inside a company. But to, you know, for that to be reasonable, you need to be a certain size and be requiring certain types of skills that an agency can provide. So, you know, unfortunately, a lot of this has become commoditized and democratized with software.
Yeah.
That's the reality. And to your point, you know, leverage, yes. And we had a system, we had a process, you know, had to build stuff and quote stuff and get it out and invoice for it and collect the money. And, you know, the system would work. And that company still runs today, by the way.
Oh,
it still operates. Yeah. It's still carrying on. It's been sold twice to two other companies, but, you know, it's still the original people are still there. Some of them are still there. You know, they loved that job and we created a great company, a great culture. And it's just from a, you know, a business perspective, we just, yeah, grinded for so many years. It was brutal. And you don't get that scale. That's exactly right.
Yeah, you don't get that exponentiality, do you?
It's true. And you know, I think that's for anyone as well. You know, at the end of the day, being part of a company that is going to scale, that means that you have the opportunity to grow as well. You know, even if you're not necessarily starting the company, joining a company that's scaling, joining a company that's growing, means that you have the chance to grow and you have the chance to expand and, you know, grow with it as well. And that's incredible.
Yeah. So let's talk about Finder, Fred, because I read, and maybe my research is correct, maybe it's not, but I read that that's, you know, basically a $100 million business versus a $2 million agency, which is a, you know, massive multiple. It's a massive uptick. And so I wanted to ask you, how did, you know, Finder start? What was the impetus for that? And I guess what was the problem that you were solving? I think I understand it, but just from your perspective, what was that problem that you saw that was big enough that you needed to, you know, put your time, effort, and energy into?
Well, I think the first part of it was we decided that we wanted to build a product. Not offer a service. And, you know, and to some extent, Finder is a service, but it's actually a product that provides the service, right? So that was the beginning. We weren't going to sell hours. We refused. No more time and materials. Not going to happen. sorry, just going back to the time and materials, there is another way to scale an agency and those kind of things. And that's where you take an equity or take a position inside your client. I think that model is scalable because you're building up to something. Yeah. But in the biggest sense, you know, I definitely think, no, it's definitely not that scalable. So that was the first rule. The second thing was we thought, hey, we want to do something that leverages all the marketing skills that we've mastered. Mm. So you kind of translated, you know, building websites, doing SEO for clients, doing email marketing, buying ads, you know, building ads, building campaigns, all that stuff, and translating that around and doing turning it into an actual business model. That was the skills we had, you know. So naturally, we were gravitated towards anything that did that. I don't think it was a, you know, oh, let's go and do this. Let's go and decide to do that. Or, you know, that's a really smart and brilliant idea. We just thought, hey, this is a cool little business. This kind of would do some cool stuff. Let's go and try that. And it naturally built upon itself. It naturally scaled and gained momentum because we just loved to do it.
Mm.
It played into our masteries. It played into our 7 years of the actual work we did and the great results we got for our clients because we cared so much and just started doing that for ourselves. That was the change. Mm. When you know, as if you think about it from a hedge fund, the most I think the wildest hedge funds are the ones that don't take in client money. Instead, they trade their own money.
Mm.
And that's kind of what we became. You know, instead of taking in clients, we started just doing it for ourselves.
Okay. So I read in your, I can't remember where I read it because I've read so many things about you over the last little while, but I read somewhere, and I think it was in Finder, that you employed some fairly aggressive SEO tactics at the outset and Google might have given you a bit of a slap.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Oh, well, you know, I think we pushed the boundaries of SEO a bit too far.
Yep.
Now, you know, we went to pretty much Google jail and
purgatory, never to return kind of thing.
Pretty much. You know, a lot of domains don't return.
Yeah.
But we went down, I'd say, 250 places to the backyard of Google and we lost pretty much all our traffic. And that was devastating, right?
Yeah.
That's basically kills what we're doing. And I think then what sort of happened is we had to go and rebuild that. And that was the moment where we decided to become a brand.
Yeah.
Okay. Where we decided to stop, you know, just doing tactics and start building a real business.
Nice.
And, you know, kind of like, you know, those companies in the yellow pages and they call themselves AAA Plumbing and, you know, everyone called them because they were the first listing.
Yeah, Aardvark, childcare and all that sort of stuff.
Yep. And it was like that to some extent. You know, that's all good and well as a tactic, but it's not a long-term strategy.
No.
And that was that triggered that. And that was a learning and I'm grateful for that, you know. All these adversities just, you know, have steered us to a great course of where we're going, which is awesome.
So I wanted to, I'll get into where you're going in a second because I know you're doing a lot of innovation in the fintech space. I wanted to ask you about data. Yeah, data is a currency these days and it doesn't seem that long ago, to me at least, maybe I'm just showing my age, where, you know, the whole concept of data was, yeah, there, but not quite in the same way that it is now, and how data is used now is quite sophisticated. I wanted to ask you your thoughts around where data's going. What sort of future do you see? I know there's the things like Dash Button, other things that, you know, smart devices to assist with commerce and so on, but just more broadly than those, you know, individual applications, you'd be collecting a lot of data with Finder and so on and so forth. What's the great insights that you've seen around the application of data?
Well, I think only of recent, I would say that we've started to employ data to deliver really, you know, interesting insights to customers. I think in the past, a lot of that data was for us determining conversion rates and making decisions about how to shape the website. And, you know, it's basically a decision tool to some extent.
Yeah.
You know, these days, I think what we've been doing is translating what we see from, you know, we're taking in a lot of customer transactions and we're analyzing similar people with similar credit scores and similar, you know, ages and incomes and saying, hey, it's interesting, this person pays 4% on their home loan, this person pays 3%. You know, maybe they'd be interested in seeing that.
Mm.
So it's kind of like, I think the revolution is this idea where you can anonymously use data to share insights between people to gain an insight or an advantage in life. That's mm-hmm. what we really are really focused on for us. I definitely think there's a lot of other companies that have done a lot of incredible things, you know, with data. I can only talk from our experience, you know, obviously. But One of the biggest challenges, I think, with data is just getting it clean in the beginning. It's really hard.
Yeah.
And storing it in a way that can be, you know, modified, analyzed, that's really, I know that sounds kind of elementary, but it kind of all starts and begins there. And then I think there's some really incredible tools that are now starting to come out and be a lot cheaper that I think a lot of really big companies were using in the past and gaining a big edge. But, you know, we're starting to be able to use those and they're becoming democratized more. A lot of open source data warehouses starting to come out as well, so people kind of self-host them. And I think that's where the change is. Right now it's all pretty collated with the big cloud providers. But I think that's going to actually change again and people are going to own their own data and run their own data warehousing and data processing and make insights. I think that's the next trend that's going to happen with storage and data. And because that's what happened with, you know, CMSs. You remember CMSs? It started off, everyone had proprietary CMSs. Yes. Everyone was paying this little company and that little company. And then WordPress came out and said, hey, have it for free.
Yeah.
And you can host it and then come back and buy our plugins and our tools and our themes and our all those kinds of bits and pieces. And our hosting, cool, awesome. But you own your CMS, which is, I think, going to start to happen with your data warehouse and your data processing. Those tools are going to become open source.
I think that's really fascinating because there's going to be a ton of data, obviously, that we'll be able to, you know, gather. And as you say, getting clean data is going to be important. But I think it'll be really fascinating. I think, you know, if you take your own data set and then compare it to, you know, some other sort of industry benchmark or norm, or, you know, maybe it's around health, maybe it's around business, maybe it's around any other element of your life, finance, you know, buying things, whatever it happens to be, purchasing histories and so on. I think, do you feel that there's going to be able to have a more customized experience using this data? So, you know, for me, I might be interested in, you know, a particular thing, and therefore by comparing my data to whatever's out there, I'm going to be able to have a better user experience as a consequence of that, rather than sorting through hundreds of hours of, you know, guff or things that I'm not interested in. Do you think we're going to be able to enhance customer experience with this data?
You know, definitely. So maybe I'll give that in perspective. What does that actually feel like as a customer? So I think the difference is when we all go to our bank, we're shown, you know, two or three credit cards that they think are target segments that they can go and market to and have a competitive advantage. And you get to see a limited set to a large degree, right? Yep. That was the past experience. I think the future is where you have headless banks, where you don't really care what brand it is. And you can switch almost instantly. There is open banking and this consumer data, right, will drive right access. It'll be a couple of clicks and it'll switch. That world, it to me, is the future of banking, where it's all in one place and you access a third-party, non-biased application to run, I guess, be your financial operating system to some extent. And products plug into that, right? That's it's turning it around from where being a world where it has proprietary software, proprietary products, and you have to buy into this ecosystem, to being, again, open and things can snap in, snap out. That's the rails that are being built and the future of banking and finance that I see.
In what time frame do you reckon?
So I think the next 12 months will be very interesting. So open banking just launched in Australia. It's been live in the UK, and we do work in the UK, you know, rolling out our app there as well. And that's been going for about 2.5 years now in the UK, and it's booming. Massive transactions. Same thing in Australia. It's just started slow. There's three providers. But I think that's next 12 months, a lot more providers will get approved. A lot more products and technology will be built. And I think you're going to see a Cambrian explosion of financial technology in Australia. We're about to see the biggest thing in finance is about to happen, as big as the internet affected finance. This is huge. It's massive.
Okay. So, I mean, for those people who don't work in that space or aren't innately familiar with it like you are, obviously what I'm hearing you say is, you know, the whole big four bank thing is going to go. We're going to have some portal that will access whatever product underneath that might be underwritten by, you know, some sort of financial institution, bank or otherwise. And we set our own parameters around that, and there'll be some sort of search function that will match us with products and services that meet our parameters. Is that essentially what we're talking about?
Exactly right. You're going to have a view and technology built that doesn't just prioritize and preference one brand.
Yeah.
That's new. I know it sounds strange, but it's just never been done. That technology's never been built. There are lots of functions that financial companies could have built, but it's not in their interest to build them.
No.
In fact, banks and insurance companies and telcos, they have incredible developers, incredible product people. They have built amazing technologies. You think, go back in time, we were using little paper books not that long ago.
Yeah.
Little paper books to determine what, where our money was and how much money we had, right? They brought about an actual computer revolution to banking. They did it again with the internet. So they're great technologists. Just that they don't have an incentive financially to build some of the other technology that, that help customers make, help them with decisions, help them with advice, give them context, give them the level of financial acumen that is required to win, you know, in a relatively complex financial world, and make it fair, democratize that, democratize that information, democratize those frameworks and mental models. And I think that's new, which, you know, I'm super excited about that.
Well, mate, it sounds amazing. And I think, you know, all of us are kind of waiting for that day where we're not reliant or having to, you know, deal with the big four or whoever else. And what's really interesting is I think about your journey, you know, you've had this skill set you've developed as a young man in marketing, you know, website building, SEO, you know, running campaigns, buying ads and so on. You've then taken that skill set into Finder. And that's obviously been a massive success, clearly. And then you've taken that skill set again, and yeah, and obviously your skill set is expanding and developing as you go. And it seems to me now that you've taken this development skill set now into open banking. It's like this continuous evolution of the skill set and further application of it. Is that how you see your journey?
Yeah. You know, I explore the territories around me and go with, yeah, my flow, really.
Yeah.
I think there are an abundant amount of problems still unsolved in the world.
I want to ask you about opportunity identification, because you would be in a space where there's probably opportunities coming across your desk every 5 minutes, and some of them are fantastic opportunities, no doubt, and some of them are probably duds. But I wanted to ask you, what's your evaluation process for opportunities? How do you sit down and think about which opportunities you want to pursue and what are worth your energy? What's the decision-making matrix around that?
So a lot of the time I look at the inertia or energy that is required to either master some new skills or rally some resources or gain what I call an escape velocity to go live. And I measure that. So I'm thinking, okay, you know, when you look at an idea, how likely is this to actually get up? Because there's so many ideas, right? But what are the ones that have the cadence, momentum, the natural gravity to actually get up and go live? Because most ideas just sort of sit on the runway. And when you have the cadence, and I think of that as like timing. So ideas have timing. And when they have the right energy, they're in the right place, they have the right gravitational pull, I think, can I make a multi-ball win, right? Can I move something slightly so that a whole lot of things continue to affect a whole lot of other things, and then that naturally adds to the bigger ball of Finder to keep going? And so a lot of, you know, I don't know if you've ever played pinball, but
I have spent many an hour trying to tilt the machine, my friend.
Well, you know, when you're going for the multi-ball,
yeah,
that to me is what I'm trying to aim for all the time with these decisions.
Yeah.
You know, how can I unlock a massive multi-ball?
Yeah. Okay.
And that's just, you know, it's not easy. It's not always, it requires saying no most of the time and then saying yes when you're a little bit scared.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so, okay, let's talk about that fear. You know, is that something that you kind of consciously have to overcome, or you've done enough analysis that you've got some confidence that even though there's a bit of fear, you take the plunge and get on with it anyway, or how do you manage that fear?
Strangely, I feel nervous.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I've done these things before, but then I'll notice that and I go, ooh, I'm a little bit scared about this. Yeah. That's exciting.
Ooh.
And normally when that happens, I know that's a key trigger to go for it.
Nice.
But that's taken a long time to adapt to that kind of energy. That's a learned behavior.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. So, Fred, I want to ask you, you know, you were featured on the AFR Rich List, and yeah, which is a fantastic achievement. And I wanted to ask you, is there any pressure that comes with that kind of listing, or is it just a nice recognition? You kind of go, oh, that's nice, and move on. Or is it a case of, you know, I've had this, you know, wonderful success that is Finder, am I now meant to be doing a bigger and better thing second time, you know, for the next thing? You know, ladies and gentlemen, for my next trick, you know, I present da-da-da. Is there any pressure around that? Or is it just a nice accolade? You go, oh, that was good, and move on.
I think it's a nice recognition. I think it's a key recognition to Frank, you know, who has joined me as the founder and finder of the whole journey, and Jeremy as a co-founder, you know, along that journey, and all the crew at Finder. I see that as a recognition moment in time, and all the greatness that they've achieved and where they're going. I think that's key. I think in terms of the expectations which I set myself, do I feel worthy of them? Yes. Do I feel satisfied with them? No. And I always think that it's okay to have one thing you're dissatisfied about in life. Everything else, like, really, come on. Like, you should, you know, really? Like, you know, you didn't get, you know, your almond latte didn't, you got burnt this morning? Really? Like, or, you know, your delivery of your shoes came 2 days late? Come on. Really? Nah.
Yeah.
And in the scheme of things, but I give myself permission to have one thing I'm dissatisfied about.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I'm not satisfied that I have achieved my higher, or what I see as a purpose or a goal of creating something no one's ever created before, something different and unique.
Yeah.
And that's the journey I'm on. It's a feeling that I think will take a long time to come. Like, you know, we sold another business just recently, a cryptocurrency brokerage called HiveX, and that was great. You know, it was a small sale. Cool. Celebrate. Awesome. But I didn't feel, from this is just, I guess, me personally. Mm. So I want to give you context in answering this. It's just about, this is my journey. Everyone has their own ones, and full credit to their journey and how they want to operate. So this is not the be all and end all. It's just how I feel about these things. And
sure. That
is, I realize that my journey is not a monetary journey. It is a journey of personal legacy.
Nice.
And I think that's taken me a long time to realize and recognize about myself. But I love to create things. I love that. I absolutely love it. And I want to create something because no one has ever created before, and for it to create a legacy.
It's really interesting that you use that word around legacy and, of course, creativity. And one of my thoughts around business and life is there's a lot of artistry in business. You know, when I think of artists, you know, typically you'll think of a painter, sculptor, photographer, or someone like that. But I actually think that there's a lot of artistry that goes into building something that's unique, something that's an extension of you. How much of your business is art and how much is science?
So I think the business in and of itself is probably a good 80% science and 20% art these days.
Yeah.
That's the business.
Yeah.
I think myself personally, but definitely probably in the 50-50 space these days.
Yeah. You
know, really digging deeply into the artistry of the creation, the manifestation of something and some things. And, you know, if everything was a science, you know, everyone would do it, right?
Oh, totally. But, exactly. Follow the bouncing ball, step-by-step process, and it's not that way.
Yeah. But, you know, it's not. I think creation and creativity is about taking risks. And that's you know, what's an entrepreneur? See, that's a key question, right? In my mind is, and look up, if you look up the definition, it's to create a business and take financial risks and benefit from the rewards.
Yep.
And, you know, I think doing that in an incredible way requires a lot of creativity, and to find a lot of other creative people as well, and a lot of incredibly organized people, and a lot of tactical people and scientific people, and people who can know how to organize people and manage people and lead people, and bringing those all together into a cohesive approach. I think that creation and that creativity and that curation, that's probably where the art is, and the science is probably in the, you know, the dollars and cents and the logical and the rational side.
Yeah And of course you need the both of them. You've been really, really generous with your time today, mate, and I want to say thank you. It's an interesting and fascinating peek into a world that we don't get to inhabit that often, but I think that the thought processes and the skills are immensely transferable. As we wrap up, I want to just ask you one quick question around mindset. And I heard you speak on a few podcasts. As I said, I did some research prior to coming to talk to you, and I heard you talk about scarcity and abundance. And I think it's a really important topic. And I think that all of us can fall into scarcity. I think all of us can take our eye off what is fulfilling for us, or where our energy needs to be directed, and we can look over our shoulders a bit too much, or look left or look right and compare. I wanted to ask you how you see the relationship of scarcity and abundance in entrepreneurship or in business, and of course, how to try to remain abundant more than slipping into scarcity.
So when I think about, let's go back to a fundamental principle. We're in a universe at its absolute core that is continuously expanding.
Yep.
And time is, you know, it obviously is another dimension in our lives. And but if you, what I've always thought in and of itself, what I love, and I want to go back to talking about scarcity and abundance. There's a lot of, you have a lot of time, you have an abundance of time. And I have noticed in life, regardless of anything, the longer you invest and commit and invest that abundance that you have and translate that into and manifest and focus your energy and attention upon what you want to create, you will eventually become abundant.
Absolutely.
And the scarcity, I think, falling into that, there's a limited amount of resources and time and those kind of things. Sure, I think I can understand, I can empathize with that as a first look. But when you zoom out and you start to appreciate and look and channel together all of the hours collectively that you are committing and enrolling to what you are going to do, that stacks up. And there is only one thing and one way that that energy can go, and that is to manifest greatness. And when I think about this, I think, you know, there's lots and lots of things to do. Normally, when there's a tight market, you know, and there's a certain number of players, yes, you're going to get your fair share. But that's the beginning, because normally when you get to that point and you hit some sort of, you know, static level or some sort of plateau, that is the moment in time where if you want to lean into a world of abundance, this is a moment where you need to innovate. You need to make a leap forward, not an incremental improvement. That's very different. I'm talking about going from an iPod to an iPhone.
Yeah.
To take that leap to go from just a music player to a phone, music player, and internet browser wrapped into one.
Yep.
That is an innovation. That is a disruptive innovation. That is where you take a leap of unknown risk towards abundance. And those are yes, high risk, and they may not all work, but with enough time, enough commitment, and enough continued emphasis, and what I call, which is really important, taking responsibility for that, to innovate and commit to yourself to doing that and taking those risks continuously.
Yep.
That is a formula in which I believe creates abundance, because there's always something new. There's always something new the customer needs. There's always something changing. And that is the place of abundance. It's continuously being created and changed.
Yeah.
100% you can guarantee on change. And that new space where that new thing is happening, everyone's on the same playing field. No one gets an unfair advantage. And I'm always committed to that place, finding that place. Where is the new thing? What can I do new? Add that to what we're doing. And there is a continuous source, like imagine an effervescent fountain of abundance of new things that are happening continuously in this world and getting faster and faster. That is why I believe the world is abundant.
Mate, that's fantastic. I love that. That commitment to that new space, that commitment to, you know, playing in that field is really, really interesting and really inspiring. And I know there's going to be a lot of people listening to that. I'm thinking, I've got a particular friend of mine, Gareth, if you're listening, I'd like you to go back and listen to this podcast 100 times. I think that's a really, really key thing to drag out. And I'm really grateful to you for sharing it. As I am grateful to you for sharing everything we've spoken about today, Fred, you've been a really thought-provoking, interesting, and I might say surprisingly philosophical guest. I've enjoyed hearing your thoughts. I've enjoyed hearing your philosophy as much as I've enjoyed hearing of your success and story, because it's the thought process that really fascinates and interests me. And I can see and I know that there's a lot of deep thought that goes into the work that you do. And I'm looking forward to seeing what you create next. So thank you so much for doing the work that you do. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thanks for the opportunity, Jesse. You ask great questions and you get great answers.
Thanks, mate. You're a champ. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.